Today is Thursday. It's January 3rd, 2019. It's 11:18 in the morning. Happy New Year. This is John Williams, and we are the Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record in the studios of WGN Radio in Chicago. You can hear me weekdays from 1 to 3 and Saturdays from 10 to noon. Scott Stantis.
I'm Scott Stantis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune and creator of the comic strip Prickly City and co-host of the Prickly City podcast right here on WGN Plus.
Justin Kaufman, co-host of Steve Cochran Show as well as The Download.
I'm Eric Zorn, the rapidly aging columnist from the Tribune.
I was going to say something about that.
Thank you for not.
Eric celebrates his something's birthday on Sunday.
Big one.
61. No, not the big one. Well, 61. They're all big.
It's a big
point.
One.
Yeah.
I don't know. 61 is the new 45.
Horse crap.
That's no,
so
really.
Untrue.
Untrue. Speaking on behalf of those of us that are 59 and looking down the barrel of 61, yes. It's okay. Look at that. You're able to sit up, take fluids. You're good. You're solid.
Yes, solids are the problem.
Solids are the problem.
Our top news today, the wall, the wall, the wall, the wall.
I will build a great, great wall, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall.
Shutdown continues. Who should blink first? Who will blink first, Justin?
I am always intrigued by the president's negotiation tactics because they're so chaotic. But by design, this president has, we've seen in the last 3 years, every single idea that he needs, or everything he needs to negotiate, he does it in such a kamikaze, chicken-like way. He wants you to believe that he's crazy enough to keep the government shut down forever. And he does it in a way that I think he's successful at it, because you want to play a hard line. Democrats don't want to give him any money, but they're like, he's crazy enough that he will keep it shut down. And I wonder if that works. It seems to be working maybe with China and trade. It seemed to be working, and obviously with what happened with Canada and Mexico. Will it happen with border security? I put my money that Trump will win.
What, in what ways is it working with China?
I mean, yeah, it's really not.
My take on this is first of all, both parties have really locked themselves into positions of they're both seemingly intractable positions. Trump has said that he won't negotiate on this because then he would look foolish, is the quote that he said. And it's like, what do you mean? Then you're going to look foolish? hello. But I don't see Trump just caving. And the Democrats have put themselves into this very strong negotiating position. They're not going to give any money for the wall. They need to find some sort of a face-saving third way.
Who's they?
They, both parties together. They need, because both parties, their base, the Democratic base voters are really, really firmly opposed to giving them any money for a new wall building. And the Republican base is going to go nuts if Trump blinks on that. So they're going to have to figure out some way where they can say, well, we're going to give, you know, $10 billion to a whole bunch of different border security things, but it's not going to be the wall, but it's going to be an electronic wall. It's going to have to be some sort of verbal gymnastics that's going to save Trump's, because he won't back away from this. He's just trollish enough not to.
What Justin touched on, which I think is entirely accurate, is the fact that the president's negotiations are schizophrenic. He'll say, I can negotiate. We're going to compromise on this. And then he'll say in front of some MAGA crowd, no negotiation. We need the wall. How do you negotiate with someone who's
That's why I quibble with the word tactics. I don't think he thinks tactically.
Yeah, but he ran on the idea that he's a businessman who's good at negotiation.
But he's not. But he's not. And I don't even know that he was a good businessman. Isn't it evident that he's not a good negotiator in that he's put the Democrats in a position where if they even talk to him, they lose face? If you were manipulative, if you were clever, you would have sweetened the deal somehow. You would have said nice things about him.
They had a deal. Remember, long ago was it where they had a deal?
Had something on the table. Durbin talked about it.
With DACA, and they were going to do
the Senate signed off on it. They were set to go.
And Trump just said no way. He wasn't going to give it.
Well, that was a switcheroo. Wasn't that after the social media, after the conservative media sort of lambasted him for acquiescing a little bit, and then he sort of said, okay, I'm not going to take less. I need more, and I'm not going to negotiate. I've got to have the border wall.
I still remember when he called everybody into his office and they had that thing in front of the cameras where he said, you guys work something out and I'll sign it, if you remember that.
Right.
And then they did work something out and he wouldn't sign it. I I'm totally on board with the idea that he's not a very good negotiator, that he is a bully, and that bullying has worked to some degree in the New York real estate market, but it doesn't work in politics.
Oh, it works pretty well. It really does.
This is Bruce Rauner thought it was going to work.
But Bruce Rauner's not a bully. This guy is a real bully. Mm-hmm. And who's president of the United States? I'm trying to think. Oh, yeah, it's Donald Trump. So clearly this is effective.
The rhetoric works, but the negotiating tactic, what has he successfully negotiated in 2 years?
Well, as you both of you guys scoffed at China, I will say that his concept, the concept was he wanted to go in and change the way we do business with China because he felt like the United States is getting ripped off. So he goes in and he is playing a game. It's a dangerous game, but it's a game of financial chicken where he is running at the – and it kind of reminds me of the scene in Footloose, where they're on the tractors and they're going at each other, Bacon's foot is caught.
Hey, sport, when this hat flies in the air, you better have your butt in gear.
Stupid idiot!
But then they're like, man, this guy's crazy. So he jumps off and he actually wins. I feel like Trump's foot is caught. Like he's caught between all of the party's power and the
his tie because it's so damn long.
But China and others, and I think Democrats in this case, just don't know if this dude's crazy enough to be like to plow in to actually have that moment in the game of chicken where you collide with each other. And I think that that's his strategy. I think Trump is, I've been watching over and over and over how he dealt with Europe and the EU and how he deals with the G7 and NATO, how he's dealt with China, and now how he deals with politics and Democrats. There is a pattern if you want to see it, and it's, I'm so crazy, you don't know what I'm going to do, so let's settle.
In this instance, I think there is a tactic here, and that is, he doesn't back down. What is it? 25% of the government's shut down, so it's annoying to some people, and NPR runs stories about, you know, someone who can't get their passport or something. But for the most part, it's not impacting people that much. And so he can stay the course. And this is I think this is a brilliant move on his part. Because at the end of the day, if he wins, even nominally wins this, he said, I stood tough against the Democrats. I won, winning.
I think that's why they won't cave either, though. CBS ran a story, and they're looking for the impact. You know, when you do a partial government shutdown over the holidays, it's sort of like if a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it. Only now are we actually going to begin to see real impact.
Yeah, so far the stories have been like, there's trash overflowing the bins in the national parks.
A couple couldn't get married at a national park. Somebody couldn't get their marriage license.
Newlywed Christina Cruz wants to change her name before her honeymoon.
Were you planning on doing that anytime soon?
Yeah. It was going to be in the next few days.
So. Wow.
These are all annoyances and inconveniences. There's two kinds of employment, though, in the world, right? 100% and 0%. If you're in the 20% that's not getting a paycheck, this is very real. It's 800,000. 800,000 families are missing a paycheck.
Right.
And that's 20-25% of the federal workforce,
and
which
I imagine
makes me think we have a bloated federal workforce.
I imagine a lot of them can survive one or two missed paychecks, but they're not going to be able to survive a couple of months.
How many of you guys would like to miss a paycheck at Christmas time? Here it's the first of the year now, and you've got a mortgage, you've got bills, you ate and drank too much, and now you don't have money coming in.
No, it's terrible.
You'll survive,
I'm saying one paycheck, most families probably survive, like I said, one paycheck, maybe two, especially given that most of these people are going to get paid eventually. But at some point, when they're just not getting paid at all, then you're going to really start to feel some economic reverberations that are going to be serious. The question then becomes which party, which person, which group of people pays the price? Which one is the public going to take it out on? Right now, I think that the Democrats are winning the public relations war.
They're
going to pass on Thursday, they're going to pass this bill opening up every bit of the government except Homeland Security. You know, McConnell won't even bring it up.
Right.
And so I think the people who are only paying a little bit of attention to this go, well, the Democrats had a bill that they passed to open up the government, and the Republicans said, no, they want their wall. Wah, wah, wah.
What's the matter, Scott?
The people aren't paying attention. What people pay attention to is the soundbite and the image, and their image of the people who are leaning towards wanting the wall, which is a winner because it polls very well.
The wall and does you not poll well. Wait.
It
the
polls
wall
very
does
well with his base.
With his base.
That's
and,
all.
And Republicans are 80% of them want this thing to happen.
Right.
He's playing to them. He's playing tough. I mean, this is, I think he's winning this. But in terms of the shutdown, doesn't this feel a little bit like the Rauner budget crisis here in Illinois.
737 days, whatever it was.
You never felt it. Initially, it was...
You didn't feel it.
The construct, well, most people in the state, it was a slow build.
That is the danger that I truly believe that, as you saw, and I think that the president knows this, the tweet today, this morning, was, this is just the Democrats' way to politicize this so they can win in 2020. He's recognizing that there is at least the idea that there could be political fallout for him.
That's why I think the Democrats are actually in the driver's seat.
I think they're in the driver's seat, too.
And I think they can hold their breath just as long as him. We all have the video of him telling Schumer, I'll own this thing. It'll be on me. It is on him. And it is, by extension, on the Republicans as well. I mean, they're waiting for him to greenlight something that they will agree to. It's not the other way around. So ultimately, I think they are going to tell him, we don't have the House. You don't have the public support. You have to find some verbal gymnastics, Eric, to back out of this thing, to say, okay, now I'm the adult in the room. I mean, he can pivot on anything. He changes his mind on numbers and facts and opinions all the time.
And where's his base going to go, honest to God? Here's the thing.
Good
I mean,
point.
If I were the Democrats...
What are they going to do? Say, well, now we don't love you?
Yes, they need him for this next Supreme Court vacancy, which may come up soon. And if I were the Democrats right now, I would be running ads that have that soundbite from the meeting in the office with Schumer and Pelosi and Trump, where he's going, this is my shutdown, I own it. Then I would be running a lot of clips of him talking about how Mexico is going to pay for the wall, because the thing that ought to just be infuriating to his supporters is that he said over and over and over again that Mexico would pay for this wall, and now he's asking taxpayers to pay for the wall.
If we get the trade deal with Mexico, if it actually passes the Congress, then we'll somehow capture more revenue, and that will offset the cost of the wall. That's his latest line. If that happens and we somehow capture more money from Mexico, that's your money. That's the American taxpayers' money. Now, we could take the money from you taxpayers and build the wall, but that's not Mexico paying for the wall. To me, that's pretty apparent, but that doesn't seem to bother anybody out there.
There's this thing I always wonder about when they say that Trump usually says on Twitter that the Democrats don't care about border security, but then you see their compromise where they're putting 2.8 billion or 3.8, and things have changed. Is there any way that a Republican base would accept a Democrat compromise?
Well, they did. I mean, they did last month. They had a compromise all worked.
No, but I mean, not the Republican senators and congressmen. We're talking about the Republican base. Would a Republican voter say, "Yeah, Democrats did a good job. $3 billion's okay, then $5 billion."
What's the Republican base? Define that,
Scott. I don't mean it in a negative way. Would a voter say, "Yeah, you know, the Democrats came through for us"?
You know what I'm?
Yeah,
that, implicit in that is that Trump.
No.
Trump supporters are not the same as the Republicans.
Yeah. Okay.
The thing is that I've said this before on this podcast, that Trump has built up this idea of the wall and the structure of a wall as something that is totally symbolic of his attitude toward immigration. And if you want to talk about maybe getting, like I say, $10 billion or $15 billion for a whole array of new border security, the Democrats, despite what some people say, the Democrats are not for open borders. Nobody in the Democratic Party, except for a few people on the far fringes, are for open borders. The Democrats are okay with enhanced border security, but they have, because of Trump's rhetoric, the wall has become this sticking point.
Yeah.
So if you were to say, okay, well, instead of $5 billion for the wall, we'll give you $10 billion for this array of electronic and other sorts of things that might include some fencing, but then Trump could declare a victory, and the Democrats could say, we didn't give him his
would
big,
you be okay
huge
with that?
Damn wall. I would be. Yeah. I don't know if they need $10 billion. I'd like to see, though, somebody make the case that we need. I mean, we've had net negative migration to Mexico since like 2002.
Oh, you can't make that case. Look, the whole thing. You're right.
Because of the migrant hordes, the caravan.
There could be any line in the sand, but this is the line. The wall is the line in the sand. That's why I just think the Democrats absolutely won't capitulate on this, because it's not about a wall. It's about what the midterm election was. It was about, we don't want Donald Trump's print. And if you give on this, even though you could, it's $2 billion. I was thinking about this the other day. There's many Americans who could, from their checking account, resolve this issue. I mean, think about that. This whole federal debate could be solved by private citizens. And I don't mean a GoFundMe page.
The Koch brothers.
The Koch brothers could just cut a check.
You could see a scenario, though, and that's what Eric is saying, where everyone could say they won. You could see the Democrats say, we'll give you $5 billion for border security, but it's for tech. It's for maybe, like you said, some fencing, but not a wall. And then you could see Trump say, I didn't get you the wall, but I got you the big money. You know, I mean, can everyone claim victory if the if the number goes up?
I think, well, or the president
would do that, or the president, he would agree to that.
I don't know that he would. I really think the wall, I mean, I know it's a four letter word. It's so funny. That's what we're stuck on. And that's what's hanging. Everything is hanging on that. The wall is, it's symbolic. It's solid. It's tangible. People get it.
It was a great campaign ploy.
Yeah.
It was a great, it got you elected.
Why doesn't he just declare bankruptcy and go back to Mar-a-Lago? I mean, that seems to me like what he's done seven times in his life.
Okay, the last thing I'll just say about the petulance of this president is the way he played the poor woe is me, I had to celebrate Christmas and New Year's Eve all by myself. I think he knows that's ridiculous and he's just trying to be funny about it, but he's not good at that craft to actually make it come across. So what did you do? You didn't go to Mar-a-Lago, but you got to spend the holidays with your family in a mansion in Washington, D.C., where a lot of people want to go during the holidays anyway. I didn't see the hardship in it.
I was in the White House all by myself for six, 7 days. It was very lonely. My family was down in Florida. They're all, I said, stay there and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, I wish I had my violin here. I would play a sad song. You know, yeah, you're right. And, but I think
he is a violin player, by the way.
He does have this self-awareness to realize that going to play golf at Mar-a-Lago would be really bad optics during a government shutdown. So he's not going to be able to go play golf for the duration of this shutdown. And maybe that's going to be what's going to finally make it, you know, make him crumble.
We don't hear much about his golf game
anymore. Complaining about that as if he is, woe is me. If he's being funny, he's not doing it well enough. If he's being serious, he's not being taken
seriously. I had to be in this mansion and not that mansion.
I now call the House to order on behalf of all of America's children. Go kids! Go kids!
What about the new Congress, guys? So the 116th is unlike any we've ever seen before. There's a bunch of stories, and I'll just give you some of the highlights. Illinois' Lauren Underwood is now the youngest black female member of Congress. We have the youngest woman ever elected to Congress. That's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You have the first Muslim women in Congress, one in Michigan, one from Minnesota. Republican Marsha Blackburn will be the first female senator from Tennessee. You have the first woman elected to Congress from Mississippi. You have the first female senator elected to represent Arizona. They will have their only, the first openly bisexual senator. You have the first Latinas from Texas. You have the first Native Americans. I am heartened by the pictures of the new Congress people and what the House generally will look like. It's in stark contrast to the Senate. I don't worry that the Senate is still white and male-centric. The point is that the Congress does look like us, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, and that this is, honest to goodness, this is a great thing. I mean, I told my boys as they were growing up, you know, you're white, you're male, you're American, you're middle class. You know, that's
you're lucky.
You're lucky. You're incredibly lucky. The dynamic is going to change in your lifetime. Whites are not going to be the majority race in this country anymore. They're going to be plurality, but not majority. And you can face it one of two ways. You can fight it. You can hate it. You can rage against it. Or you can be okay with it and go forward and think that this is the diversity and the new ideas.
This is part of the message, too, Scott. And at times, it will feel unfair to you.
I grew up learning about American government and why we have sent the Senate and the districts drawn the way they are and why there's Congress is that it's wanted to represent all people, not just big states and not the elite up north, but the farmers down south. And this is just another way to think about that, that, you know, if you're going to draw up a map in 2019, it's going to be much more diverse and represent diverse populations. So it's great to see that there is this in Congress, and it should be. That's how the whole system was set up.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like Congress looking more like America is a great thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wonder, all of us here around the table, since Patty's not here this week, we were all born white men, and that is, you know, you're kind of born on third base in a lot of ways. And a lot of men resent that implication. They talk about things like, oh, well, affirmative action and so on. But for the most part, all the advantages that we had just by virtue of being born white males in this country are significant. I don't think they're going away necessarily. I mean, we're having to share some of the spoils of being in America, you know. No, I mean, I think it's a great thing. I'm looking forward to what this Congress does. I unfortunately, the House is not going to be able to do much.
To be fair, the freshman class of the Republican freshman class in the House of Representatives, all white male except for one woman. And my take on that has always been, I used to work in Republican politics when I was much younger, and I tried to push hard that we have to make inroads into Latino communities, into African-American communities, into, I mean, the gay community. It made perfect sense in terms of seeing them as, instead of trying to paint them as enemies, paint them as an advocate for family values, for lower taxes, for
those
issues.
But then you're
not
a Republican. You can advocate for equal treatment, but you... I don't know that you can advocate for all of those constituencies and still be Republican.
I think that sadly that's the metrics moving forward, and it's a tragedy because it means that the Republican Party, in my view, will become more and more marginalized in the future. Don't forget they lost the national election in 2016 by 3 million votes.
I have three Chicago, Illinois-based topics for you guys to consider. One is what's happening with the police force in Chicago. We've had, what is it, four officers in the past year have died in the line of duty. And then you've got the rash of suicides as well. The numbers aren't, I don't think, exactly documented because I don't know that we always know about the numbers of suicides. But, Eric, what's your thought about the sort of danger that officers often find themselves in?
Well, I did some research. I know you're not supposed to for a podcast, but I did. and this is the Ruderman White Paper on Mental Health and Suicide on First Responders talks about how in 2017 there were 103 firefighter suicides, 140 police officer suicides. That's more than were killed in the line of duty.
Nationally.
And that when you look at the rates of PTSD, they're much higher, five times higher among firefighters and police officers than in civilian population. So you have these considerably higher rates of suicide than in the general population. And we also have to look at the fact that suicide is the 10th leading cause of death overall in the U.S. And there are more than twice as many suicides as there are homicides every year. So this is a big problem. We don't talk about it much. Because it's a hard thing to talk about. It's a hard thing for families to confront. You were saying that we don't know the numbers on suicides, and this paper makes that same point, which is that it's a lot of times people don't. They'll say, "Oh, we died of a heart attack or something," because suicide is a very difficult subject for people to talk about.
I think the one thing to take away, especially here in Chicago, when you see those things happen and suicides are reported and you see it coming out of one district, is that first responders are and their mental health are always overlooked. We've had a lot, I say in the last decade, a real look at servicemen, military, PTSD and how mental illness plays a role
suicide
when you get
veterans,
out.
Yeah.
Veterans, the whole bit. But first responders is an area that hasn't been studied. So to see this white paper come out and for us to understand that there are parts of this job, whether you're a firefighter or a police officer, that are stressful to the human condition.
Don't you think that explains how officers are so quick to act violently? I mean, I just think it's evident the evidence of the stress they're under.
Or beyond even how they act, what they're exposed to. I mean, soldiers the same way. I mean, you're exposed to a lot of violence, a lot of, shootings and crime that you and I are not exposed to on a regular basis. I mean, we automatically chalk that up to, oh, they're callous to it. They see it all the time. But that has to have some sort of impact.
Of course.
To see grieving families and to deal with seeing a 15-year-old kid shot in a pool of blood.
But just how much of their work is adversarial anyway? Even a traffic stop is, if it goes perfectly well, is somebody having a bad day because you are about to write them a ticket.
And not to mention the work hours that go into this job and the way they do it. I know for fire departments, you're talking about a schedule where you go 20, I don't know what the numbers are, but it's, 48 hours on. Or same with police officers, and you wonder what kind of... I just think it's time for us to study that to make sure that is not contributing. Those factors aren't contributing.
Well, you got to make sure that the support systems are in place that you don't...
Yeah.
We have to really realize as a city, as a police department, they've got to really realize this is an issue, and we can't just say, tough it up. You need to have the counselors in place and the programs in place to mitigate that kind of stuff.
And they have. I was speaking with a police officer who's involved in this recently, and the numbers Eric came up with, I think it was 8 suicides or something like that, and that is far lower than actually happens. You touched on some families will just say heart attack or whatever, but a lot of them are, he was cleaning his gun, and it discharged, and And that's how they mask this number. It's apparently far higher. And yeah, PTSD is definitely a factor in this.
Do you have the number? I think that there are more gun deaths via suicide than murder in America.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah. That sounds right to me. New topic. They, meaning Bill Daley, but also Southside Church and some people on the South Side want to change the name of the Dan Ryan to the Barack Obama Expressway. I-55 from 294 to Pontiac is already named after Barack Obama, but now they want to change the name of the street in the city.
Well, they, you know, I think the Reagan Highway was renamed. The argument is, you know, they want to wait till the ex-president dies, right, before they start naming
things. I guess so.
It's not out of the realm to have an expressway named after a leader or president. Maybe wait a couple years. I don't know.
The Jane Byrne was named after after she passed away.
She
right?
was right about to die. I think.
No, she was there for the christening of it, but she didn't live much longer after that. Okay. I felt so bad for her too, because the intersection that's named after Jane Byrne is a terrible place for cars. I said this on the air. I'll say it to you guys. If anything good enough ever happens to me that somebody wants to honor me when I die, don't let them name a road after me in Chicago. Because all it's going to be is, I'm on the frickin' Williams. Really, is Barack Obama honored by changing the name of the Dan Ryan
to
him?
Of course he would be.
Of course he is. He's already going to have his center on the South Side.
You know, I generally subscribe to the Hall of Fame rule. You know, baseball doesn't let people into the Hall of Fame until 5 years after they've retired or died. Because you want some cooling off time to make sure that, you know, just... You want the perspective of time. You don't want bursts of sentiment when someone retires to do it. But in the case of a president, you know, I'd be willing to make an exception because some major thing in Chicago is going to be named for Obama. I was going to suggest maybe that Hutchinson Field where he gave that speech down there in Grant Park would be a good thing to name for him. People have suggested renaming Lakeshore Drive for him instead of Dan Ryan, so that Dan Ryan's family is not peeved. Does everyone around the table know who Dan Ryan is?
Former county commissioner, died in office. His wife took his spot and was part of the commission to name the road.
Yeah, but see, you guys are news nerds. I think most people don't know who Dan Ryan
is. I didn't know that until I looked it up this week.
Who was Edens? Oh. Anyone know who Edens was?
I looked that up, too, and now I don't even remember.
Tony Edens?
He's a road commissioner.
Tony Edens.
Sure.
He's
a good guy.
What I'm saying is...
Get him a road.
If we name something after Bishop Ford, Barack Obama is arguably 10 times more important than Bishop Ford ever was. So I'm saying that in this case, I would think I'm fine with the idea of renaming the Dan Ryan for Barack Obama.
I would like us to try and keep it. I mean, I understand Obama and his hometown and the whole bit, but come on, there's a lot of local politicians that road should be named after, especially if the council is now deterring or limiting how you can get honorary street signs.
I think that's true.
Let's give Rostenkowski doesn't have a road. Where's the Rostenkowski Expressway?
Well, Blagojevich doesn't have a road.
You know who doesn't have a road is Richard M. Daley. He's got a branch library. I mean, that's about it. Richard M. Daley has almost nothing.
If we're going to do something to honor Barack Obama, commensurate with his worth, then let's change the name of the whole city. Let's call it Obama. We live in the city of Obama. He's
Obama,
better.
Illinois.
He's bigger and better than the Dan Ryan. I don't. It honors the road more
you're
than it does the president.
You're saying that he needs bigger honor than.
How
yes.
about Lakeshore Drive? Eric likes
Obama Pedway.
No, how about the Zorn Pedway.
I'm the bard
of the Pedway. Yeah. Now.
Eric Zorn wrote this week that he thinks that's a swell thing. It is a terrible thing.
The Pedway.
Yeah.
It's just the signage is bad. It's a great idea.
Well, then,
idea.
But what is a pedway without people knowing how to ped?
Well,
if you can't, it's the most.
I totally agree.
Dysfunctional walkway in America.
And the way I have to get from I live on the north side of the river. I come to Prudential, and I have to take the pedway that way. It's awful. I have seen things, my friends.
There's a moment if you want to connect from where we're at.
Underground walkway under the city.
We're east of Michigan Avenue, so we're in the tall buildings closer to the lake. And to get to Macy's, there's a point where you have to do it. It reminds me of the movie Superman. Do you remember in the actual original Superman with Gene Hackman, where the hideout is in a train and he goes against the wall and it slides in and then the reporter is following him and they slide it out the other way and he gets hit by the train. Do you remember that scene?
Right, yeah.
No.
That's how you feel in the pedway when you have to go through because there's a moment where you're in with the trains and you're like, you're walking and you feel very like you're in some sort of mystery intrigue like it's Da Vinci Code or something like that and I'm going to solve a big mystery.
They should literally paint
just
a yellow.
Just go to Macy's.
Like, you know, pick a spot, the Hancock, and take it all the way to Union Station. They should paint a line. You know, and then there could be branches off of it. But literally, you could just follow the yellow brick road to Time for our recommendations, things we're eating, drinking, watching, listening to, reading that we think you might enjoy too. How about you?
Well, first and foremost, you did not send me the memo because obviously people listening to the podcast can't tell, but I'm the only white male sitting here who's not in a check shirt and some blue sweater or coat.
No, this is winter look.
Yeah,
buddy.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm wearing my grandpa's sweater.
You got a cardigan.
Here.
This is nice. Yeah. It's nice, though.
But my recommendation is I just came back from and was invited to, and it was great. This is how my idea of a great New Year's Eve and New Year's Day is: the Ultima Thule flyby, the New Horizons mission. It's a Kuiper Belt object. We had no idea it existed just a few years ago. We had the better resolution photo came out yesterday. We're going to have a better one come out today and in color. And it's, if you love science, and you should, this is a remarkable thing. The you can come in to, and I'm not sure where Elif is going to post the link, but you can find it pretty easily.
And is it done in Klingon?
It's not done in Klingon. This was such a geek moment. This is my New Year's Eve, and Janine could care less.
So Kaufman, your recommendation, go.
Season 3 of Series of Fortunate Events on Netflix.
Zorn, go.
The End of the World podcast with Josh Clark.
My recommendation is Small Fry, the 2018 memoir by Lisa Brennan Jobs. I'm about halfway through it. I think I recommended that once before. It's still good. It's Steve Jobs' daughter and what life was like being his daughter growing up. And it's just spellbinding. The stories she tells are amazing. And that's this week's podcast. Thank you, fellas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Mincing Rascals are produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.